Welcome to Build, Lead, Thrive, Voices of Androscoggin, a bi-monthly podcast that features in-depth conversations with the people shaping Androscoggin County. Each episode dives into personal stories, showcasing the leaders and entrepreneurs behind the region's economic and community vitality. Hi, I'm your host, Shanna Cox, President and CEO of the LA Metro Chamber. I'm joined by local talent, longtime friend, and our producer, Mark Turcotte.
Hello there.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm lovely. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
I love this journey that we're on.
I love it too.
You're just doing all kinds of fun things in your life outside of this. So each time you do a new professional accomplishment, I'm like, blessed to say he's my producer. I get to hang out with him twice a month.
I think our guest might dispute your claim that I am a local talent.
Judging by
his comments at the LA Balloon Festival.
Oh, what I miss.
Well, I wanted to make sure that he wasn't there to make more garden jokes. But I do hear that Mark
nice tie-in
is
to annual awards.
I do hear though that Mark is starting to book out. Like if you want Mark, you
no,
need
he's
a booker.
Hot commodity.
Yeah, like yeah. I mean if as long as you get to him tomorrow, he'll answer and take the job.
Were there any garden jokes at the...
No.
Was the Balloon Festival great?
I had planned on a few.
But he just stole your thunder.
But it was requested that I refrain.
I think he just doesn't want your talent to go outside of our chamber spaces. To share it with the whole world.
That makes way more sense.
For a private audience only.
Yeah.
You don't want to ruin a chamber's brand.
That's true. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
I will accept that.
Thanks for looking out for us, Joe.
Always.
Thanks for holding a couple of joke cards close to your vest, sir. Appreciate that. You're already hearing from him, but today we're joined by Detective Joseph Philippon, a lifelong Lewiston resident whose career with the Lewiston Police Department has been defined by proactive community engagement, outreach, and innovation. We'll explore what drives his service, how he balances policing and community building, and what he sees for the future of Lewiston. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you for having me, Shanna.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I'm gonna share a little bit, and when I say a little bit, I mean like a small slice of what I could be sharing about you, but this episode only lasts about an hour, so I can't go into that much detail.
We also don't want to put people to sleep.
Well, but your resume was pretty incredible. Let's see if we can pick up some of the highlights, and then we'll dig into getting to know you a little bit more. So, Detective Joe, as many folks know him, is a lifelong resident who's been here. He's built his career and his reputation around service. He joined the police department in 2005. That is 20 full years ago.
A long time ago.
It's crazy. It is crazy how quick that time goes. I remember when you were like a beat cop, pretty new on the scene. I was new to this community, and it was interesting to see this community through your eyes at that time, and then to watch this career that I'm about to describe to you both change your lens and watch you change this community. So that journey's been an incredible arc that I've been on, and it has been 20 years.
It's amazing how fast time goes by in retrospect. And as most people would say, especially when you have children, time only goes faster. So I can't imagine, in a blink of an eye, I'm sure the next 5 years will sail right by.
No, it's exactly true. It's exactly true. So in that time, as I met you, you've worn the hats of a patrol officer, a recruiter, a community liaison, and now you're a detective. What makes Joe's work stand out is how he goes beyond the badge. So tackling not just crime, but quality of life issues, so housing and homelessness to neighborhood safety and connection. He has a gift for meeting people where they are and creating programs that bring the community together. He launched Project Support You, which pairs service professionals with officers on calls, and he reinvigorated the Community Police Academy to help residents better understand and connect with law enforcement. Outside the department, he's the force behind Lewiston's Summer Fun and Films program, helping bring new murals and public art to the city, and serves on boards that support everything from youth and housing to the arts. Whew. And that's just like what you do as part of your normal kind of day-to-day work life. But you've gotten recognized for some of this. So his leadership and outreach have earned recognition close to home and across the country, from our own Uplift LA's 40 Under 40 to the U.S. Department of Justice's COPS program. Joe, you've taught at the Maine Criminal Justice Academy, you've worked with FEMA on national training, and still somehow you make time to coach youth sports and support local nonprofits. Above all, you're passionate about helping Lewiston thrive, not just as a detective, but as a neighbor, a volunteer, a husband, and a dad.
Well, thank you. That was very warm and kind of you.
Well, I mean, it's a pretty impressive. Most folks don't tie police officers with murals. Maybe with youth sports, we see a lot of that. But you really hit on culture and community as well as athletes, athleticism, and policing.
No, I mean, anybody who knows me knows that I don't like repetitive stuff and I don't like things being unsettled. And as you could see, that I'm a fairly unsettled person, so I do like to keep myself busy and take on new projects. When I look at law enforcement or what I think ultimately what police officers should do, and they shouldn't also be worried about this because we will never work ourselves out of a profession, but our goal should be to work ourselves out of a profession. And, you know, one of the things that I've never cared to do is do the same thing repeatedly. And one of the things that being a police officer, unfortunately, you do respond to sometimes calls involving the same individual, same building, location, or same type of theme or generality. And one of the things that I was really grateful for was the experience and time that I had on our community resource team. Because that...
The Crow team, right? That's what a lot of people call it. Yeah.
One of the things that's nice with Crow is I was not tied to the radio. And the expectation that my supervisor at the time gave me, Rob Ulrich, was just simply like, your job here is like you get the extra 5 minutes that you don't get when you're on patrol. Huh. Dive in, dig. And, you know, I really took it upon myself or with that opportunity to say, okay, here are some of the things that I'm annoyed with when I was on patrol, but now I have time with, and really trying to get below the layers to figure out what it is and what's a better solution to this to negate that call for service for the police department.
I feel like your time in Crow was kind of a pivotal point in your own experience and perception change of this community. And on this show, we talk a lot about how this community is perceived, how the people I interview are working to change that perception. And, you know, I grew up in a first responder household, and realistically, first responders, whether it's, you know, fire or police or EMS, you're 9 times out of 10, you're getting called for like the worst moment, right? Like, I mean, maybe it's a birth, but the majority of the time it's not an awesome moment. And so if that's your day in, day out job, and that is 98% of what you're seeing every day, it can be really easy to think that a place that you're in is not so great. And it was through Crow that you were seeing some of the community initiatives, the community leaders, the other organizations that were proactively out there trying to address some of the things that you were seeing or dealing with the results of, you know, in your patrol shifts. And it was, I remember that being a moment in your life where you started to really think about this community. And often we talk about, like, we don't want to, like, throw lipstick on a pig. We're not trying to lie about some of the challenges that are in our region. But there are so many assets and there are so many great people and great efforts underway that it can kind of get swept under and not noticed. And so I think in Crow, when you were in Crow and started to like meet those people and work with those things, and you're not just getting called for the bad moment and a bad day, that was where I saw you really start to take this journey really, really head on.
No, I agree with you. I mean, one of the things, unfortunately, is that people don't call us when they're having a good day.
Yeah. We need a non-emergency, I'm having an awesome day number.
It doesn't happen. It really doesn't happen. It's very easy to fall into the trappings of the half-empty glass, becoming very jaded and negative, because that's all you see.
Yeah.
And of course, because that's what you see frequently, that becomes your perception of what is incomplete and in whole. And one of the things that was nice and invigorating for me was when I was on the community resource team was, and you said it, like I got to meet other people that were working in the same area as a town or in this community that I was policing, but doing different things. And if anything, it restored my sense of optimism and hope. And it really was refreshing to me, because then I also realized that some of these solutions and stuff like that, we can build, you can create. And when you're in a negative place, it's hard to see that you are able to build and create things like the transformation plan that started from an initiative that you really started, which is Healthy Neighborhoods. that was really a big deal for me personally, because I really got to better understand the neighborhood in particular that I was policing or had been policing at that time. Didn't understand the complexities of what it is like to live in poverty, mm-hmm. or the challenges of housing, transportation, access to food, and how all of these factors, if they go unaddressed or exist as they currently are, also, unfortunately, can lead to more violence and crime.
That work calls to your office.
Absolutely.
Before we dig in too much deeper, our getting to know you is just some quick questions that help us understand the man behind the badge. What gets you through a long shift? Is it coffee, tea, Red Bull, something else?
Nothing. I don't do any of that
stuff. You're just water in the, because I know sometimes you work 14, 16-hour shifts.
Water and stubbornness, I guess.
That's the right ingredient. Stubborn is the right ingredient. What's your favorite Lewiston summer tradition besides your own film series? You can't use that.
I would say we just wrapped up the balloon festival, and I'm always in awe with the balloons, and I was really grateful, I'm sure Mark was too, because it's sometimes very challenging navigating the weather for the festival.
So
and this
so.
Year we had great weather and have all of the launches go off except for the very last one. I thought it was phenomenal. And then just it's always cool to see the field come alive where you have the crowd and you have people drive in and you still don't really see much. And all of a sudden a balloon pops up and then another one pops up and then on and on and on and on and on. So it's very it's pretty neat. And also, I just like looking around, and especially you see this a lot with kids, but you see with, I guess, everybody, but kids always stick out to me, that sense of awe and wonder. It's pretty neat. We actually have a balloonist at our Summer Fun and Films, and every now and then he's been able to inflate. As you know, balloons can be very finicky.
Yeah.
But if I ever had my wish, it would be for me to be able to finish up my curtain speech, walk over, get in the balloon, and sail away.
that would be so perfect, wouldn't it?
Well, we just did Wicked, so I guess that would have been pretty fitting if I could have done it for that
And
movie.
It was the season finale.
It was.
Another quick question. Who is a role model you looked up to growing up in Lewiston?
My grandfather, Raul Philippon. I just always admired his hard work, his dedication. He was very stoic. He wasn't a man of a lot of words, but he was always there, always present, always tinkering. One thing that stands out for me in particular was towards the end of his life, he wound up losing both of his legs, and just that resiliency of still, nope, I'm going to figure out how to walk. I'm going to still be mobile. I'm going to the grocery store. I'm going to drive. You really wouldn't have known.
Honestly. Really? Didn't slow him down a bit?
No. So that's one thing I just always admired, his, like, again, I guess that unsettled feeling.
Is that the same stubborn family trait that gets you through those long shifts?
I guess so.
Might have something to do with it. If you weren't a detective, right, 5 years, theoretically, you could, what do you think you'd be doing if you weren't doing this?
Really doing, or what I wish I could do?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, that's a great question. You know, with 5 years left out of my 25, I am always thinking about what's next. And it's very challenging to figure that out. Some of the things I do like doing, I guess, is being involved in the arts and more on the production side of things, mm-hmm. fundraising and getting a show organized and together. I think one of the things that I've always kind of been envious of is people who can act and mm-hmm. just that ability to fully absorb a role. And just really, you know, honestly take a break from yourself and be somebody else. And then the different characters or situations that maybe you could portray yourself in. You know, this upcoming season at Main State Music Theater that I've been going to forever, they're doing a 1776. And I think it would be so cool to spend some weeks pretending to be somebody of significance, declaring our independence.
Yeah. I would just say, like, you should hold that dream, and I don't see why you couldn't.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I can't sing, and my hips really don't move.
Okay, so maybe not musical theater. There's other theater that does not involve all the singing and the dancing. I hear. I always enjoy musical theater myself, but I think you could try that.
Yes.
Shall we move in into our first segment, Mark?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to start with Build, and today we're going to talk about building trust in the community. You've been recognized nationally for outreach efforts like Project Support You. What inspired you to bring social services and policing together? Was it healthy neighborhoods and community resource, or I know you talked about that a little bit. Was it something else? But I mean, it's a pretty innovative program here, and it was this marriage of social services and policing that you have been recognized for.
So Project Supports You is really the reincarnation of a program that we actually had in Lewiston back when I first started in 2005. Back then, the state used to fund crisis workers to be with police departments, so they funded a position in Bangor, Portland, and in Lewiston. And of course, as times got fiscally challenging, our position got cut. But during those early years, I just got to see the benefits of having seen somebody with a mental health background, with all the licenses and resources, go to these calls, allow us to step back. The reality is this, is that, you know, everything that I wear when I'm in uniform, that's that my duty belt. That's what I wear to a bank robbery, and that's also what I wear to when you're in a moment of crisis.
Yeah.
One of the things that's important to recognize is that, you know, frankly, I didn't get into law enforcement necessarily for the mental health side. I wanted to drive fast, kicking doors, and arrest bad guys, right? And as most cops do, and that's fine. But with the lack of resources and accesses and availability, oftentimes, as we know, law enforcement is the only responder for everything. Everything. And what was beneficial with seeing the mental health program that we had then is we got to see somebody with the knowledge, with the background and the resources to go to these calls so that after it was determined that things were safe, we could take that step back, the blunt instrument, if you will, and have somebody come in who understood where this person was, diagnosis, and help them navigate really, truly what their situation was, which was mental health. So part of Project Support You was frustration and not having that support with us, because predominantly a lot of people that we interact with in law enforcement, generally speaking, have mental health and now substance use disorder. And so Project Support You is really about providing better resources to people to help mitigate future law enforcement interactions with them. You know, my inspiration for it, I guess that is in part my inspiration. Yeah. I would admit that in the initial development of Project Support You, I had to be a little bit of a nag, but, you know, eventually I found a really good partner at Tri-County, or now former Tri-County Mental Health Services.
Who Spurwink these days, right?
Spurwink today. Yeah. Who donated 10 clinical hours, if you will, of service to the program, and that's how we got this thing started. And originally it was all catered to mental health, but during that same time, that's when we started talking a lot more about opioid addiction and the epidemic that was taking place. And even then, I was uncomfortable with the subject, and it was still foreign to me. But after spending some time in many circles listening to people who were in recovery or still in active use talk about substance misuse disorder and their challenges, what I also started to realize is that there's co-conditions, like mental health and substance misuse disorder go hand in hand with each other. And
Adverse childhood experiences.
Or another. ACEs. And I realized that in many ways, my own bias was limiting what Project Support You could be. Mm. And it was that perspective that was shared with me. It was just when I said, well, I'm kind of being foolish here, being too rigid. It really needs to be also open to overdose response. And by and large, Project Support You really probably, if anything, is much more focused on overdose response and follow-up than it is on mental health because of the calls for service that we have today. But I think that's an example of community input. I'm glad that people are willing to share their experiences and their thoughts with somebody who's really naive, and that would be me. I just realized from hearing that we could do this better and make Project Support You actually be more important and beneficial in the community. So,
yeah. I really appreciate you kind of naming your own bias and perceptions, because I think so often, even when we talk about the perception of this region and how, I think even just in the last 4 or 5 years, so much of some of the negative perceptions of this region and our communities are really linked to what is visually the impact of substance use disorder and how that like actually shows up on the streets, or how we see that, how people driving by see that. And I think that same bias and concern, and I think fear of not of that which you don't know, right? So until you've talked to someone who's in recovery or, you know, actively using and trying to figure out a strategy to get into recovery, I think folks think it's like an on or off switch, and it's not. There's so much that happens with somebody who's in that space between, you know, enjoying their active use or to then moving to being addicted, no longer enjoying it, trying to find a way out, and trying to find the resources and connections to do it. And for those folks driving by or walking by the park or the street or the who might make the call, or the friends who are helping make the call for somebody who's overdosing, the not knowing piece and the bias piece, I think, is what leads to the calls, which leads to the reason for you and support you to be able to focus on it.
And quite frankly, the frustrations.
Yeah.
Right? The reality is everybody's path to recovery, if they do recover, is very different. And, you know, just because some people are able to stop doing whatever they're doing cold turkey and that works for them. And for many others, that's not going to be an option, and they're going to fall flat on their face a million more times before maybe they do.
Yeah.
And I think from a first responder's perspective, it just gets tiresome, right? And you're always dealing with it. And again, it's that negative thing. These are some of the challenges. But the reality is this, and, you know, the idea or the purpose of Project Support You is so that essentially we're going to keep giving you information, keep making ourselves be present, and so that you're aware, and just be annoying, I guess.
In the best way possible.
In the best way possible. But hopefully when that time comes for you and you're ready, we'll answer that call, and you'll have a direction and a place to go. You know, the key for mental health and recovery services is that there's really no wrong door.
Yeah.
You just got to make sure that all doors are open. And that can be, again, challenging because as the practitioner or the service provider, you just get frustrated. But the reality is when they come calling and they're ready, that's a call that you don't want to miss.
Yeah. No, that's right. Well, so all of that is a good example of how you've looked at integrating community and building trust, you know, in the course of the work of policing. I've loved what you've done with block parties and the Community Police Academy. Those are spaces where you're building trust and building community, not in the way you respond to a call or the way the call is answered, but in the way you're doing that, hopefully, to reduce calls, to build relationships, or to get better information because of good relationships. How have you seen the relationships that you've been invested in and the ones that you've worked around and helped grow, how have you seen them shape Lewiston? How have you seen that show up?
Well, I guess on a more focused level, mm-hmm. if we're talking law enforcement, some of my biggest regrets are the beginning parts of my career where I would be dismissive to the questions of what's the funniest thing you've seen, what's the scariest thing you've done, on and on and on. And oftentimes, you know, 22-year-old Joe just wanted to be like, I just want to go hang out with my friends. And why are you asking me these obnoxious, annoying questions, mm-hmm. right? In retrospect, what it is that we, or law enforcement's a very unique, different job than what most people have, right?
Yeah.
And while their questions and the language they may have been used may have been off-putting or poor, what they're really asking is, tell us what it's like to be a cop.
Yeah.
I want perspective and share it. And every single time I maybe said no or was dismissive and changed whatever, what I was really doing, really, is they were giving me a microphone and I was taking that microphone and hucking it a mile down the road.
Yeah.
When we look at the trust issues that happen today, a lot of it is from lack of communication, miscommunication, misunderstanding. So it's important that as time consuming as these conversations are and can be, that you do take that time to explain things and give perspective. Because oftentimes people don't understand why law enforcement does what they do and why and all the nuances or the lens that we have to look at it through. You know, there's a friend of mine who runs a local nonprofit with youth, and they had reached out to me and expressed frustration about how the police department had handled something, and on and on and on. And then I said, okay, And then I explained to her, about crime scene management and, you know, what our priority is. And while this may have been a bothersome to onlookers, the reality is if we would have done what a lot of people are upset and saying that we should have done, we would have actually destroyed a crime scene.
Yeah.
We're expected to enforce the law and hold people accountable for those actions. Well, we're not doing that if we destroy our own crime scene, right?
Yeah.
Is that thinking not in the immediate, but it's thinking a year, 3 years from now when we're going before trying a case, right?
Yeah.
And sharing that, you know, this person was just very much so like, you know what? I appreciate that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like it. I hate how everything is, but I know you're right.
Yeah.
That's what community policing is. That's what the purpose of the Community Police Academy is, in my opinion, is to give that extra nuance and perspective. I really enjoy meeting with people in particular who have probably more of an anti or much more of a distrust in law enforcement, because I find that especially whenever I've been able to have conversations with them, or some of them are pretty open-minded and they'll come to the Community Police Academy. Those are opportunities for you to share that information. Mm-hmm. And what I get, and I wouldn't say that they necessarily leave all of a sudden pro-cop, but what they do is this. They hit the pause, and they think about it. They take the information that they were given, and they start, Or even better, a lot of them still reach out to me today.
Yeah.
Hey, this is going on. Can you share perspective before they come to their conclusion? But, when it comes to building trust is vital. Without communication, open lines, being accessible, you're not going to have the information. And if you don't have the information, oftentimes you may not really fully understand what the issue is or what the problem is. And if you don't understand it, then how can you fix it? You know, and that's one of the things as a city, we need to understand what the issues are within the neighborhoods that we're trying to improve. And when we get a better understanding of that, then it makes it so that we can develop a much more comprehensive and real solution to it. Otherwise, we're prescribing a solution that may not at all work or may even miss the mark completely.
Yeah. There's so many spaces that I've worked over the years where one of the tenets of their group agreements is we'll work at the pace of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is and I can appreciate how that's just fundamentally not possible with some responses to calls and emergency situations. But I think the reality is whether we want to or not, we will always move at the pace of the trust. Even if we're trying to move, even if the crime scene or the emergency requires us to move faster, if the trust hasn't been built prior to that moment, it's going to be harder for a witness to open up. It's going to be harder for a small business owner to make the phone call that they're concerned about the activity happening across the street. And so, you know, whether we can plan to move at that pace or not, I think whether we like it or not, we are always moving at the pace of trust and the trust that we've built, because that's how we'll either be successful or how we'll have to put that time in to get to where we want to be.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things, when Summer Fun and Films really came along, because generally speaking, when you're doing any type of engagement, it tends to be you in front of an audience and that type of classroom dynamic, which is good. And that works for a lot of things. But where it doesn't work is for maybe people who don't want to have the time, it doesn't work for people who don't go to the meeting,
yeah.
Right? Doesn't work for the people who don't trust you and take time to go to that meeting, right? So when you look at Summer Fun and Films, part of the reason why it came to be was at an all-inclusive resort, and my wife and I decided to go see the movie The Martian. They were playing it by the pool. While we were sitting there watching a movie, what caught my attention was there was two coolers, one full of drinks, whatever. But the second cooler was actually filled with bags of popcorn that were already popped. And what I just kept seeing was the kids go over to the cooler, lift up the lid, reach in, pull the bag of popcorn out, and whatever, go about their business and have fun. But it was that visual of them taking a bag of popcorn that really resonated with me. And what I started thinking about, I was like, well, what if that cooler could be replaced with a cop? And what if the interaction is just simply that? I give you a bag of popcorn. And that's it. Very minimal. You don't even necessarily need to have any interaction verbally. You could just take the bag and go. But it's positive, right?
Yeah.
And for people that maybe are uncomfortable with law enforcement or have distrust, Or if you just have kids and you can feel all that way, but you still need something to do, it's a positive interaction that's not forced upon you. That will hopefully, as time goes on, leads to open lines of communication. The block party is another example. The origins of the block party is to just that, have fun on Pine Street in Detroit's Target neighborhood and bring people together. But it's also an opportunity, and it has been an opportunity for us to share information about the downtown transformation plan to the actual residents who are directly being targeted or affected by this plan that are always, usually speaking, generally speaking, have been the most challenging for us to educate and inform on the plan.
Yeah.
So to me, I look at it as these are opportunities. Sometimes what's really fun is to come up and design something where you're going to actually do really good work and get really good information out there. But what your audience doesn't know is that they're going to an information session, yeah. that they're going to a party, they're going to something social, yeah. but they're actually going to leave there with something a lot more than just a good time.
I'm definitely the person who like goes to community meetings. I probably sit up front even. I'm early to raise my hand. But like I recognize I am not the average person, right? And I, for so many really good reasons and at different points in my life, like I didn't have the wherewithal to go to all of the things. And so, you know, being at places when I had young kids and trying to find something that I could do with the kids that would be fun and that would also kind of scratch my itch for like being engaged or learning more. There's just not a lot. Like it's either or, I right? Mean, so like that's what I think that's what Summer Fun and Films has like really kind of cracked the code on, because you went from popcorn and a movie and I don't even know what you had for activities. Like it is now a small free fair. Yes. Six times a summer. It's no joke, right? I mean, yes. Tell folks just a sampling of what they can experience at a Summer Fun and Films.
So we do 5 free events every other week during the summer vacation. Our program starts at 6 p.m. We have things like Mr. Drew and his animals too, Ariel Jade, Party Paluga with balloon twisting, bounce houses, photo booth. We added a magician at our last event who will be joining us this upcoming year. We have DJ music, bubbles, and then we host and welcome a whole slew of nonprofits to, one, give out information, but they usually set up their own activity station. But it's just about fun, face painting, you name it. But the idea is just come, have fun. Everything's free. Everything's accessible. Also, everything is safe. And at 7:30, we start the movie.
I was going to say, and all that's before the free movie.
And all that's before the free movie.
And you're not playing old reruns. You get great movies.
I try and make sure that we only play things that have been released within the last year from when we are at the end of our previous summer season to when we launch. We give out free water and free popcorn. Walmart has been a huge supporter of this program, and arguably today, I mean, aside from Lewis and Public Works, Walmart, I don't think I could pull this off without their support. It's all of this coming together, and the thing that's really neat about Summer Fun and Films is it's really a program that originates from, well, I shared the origins of how I came to be, but the reality is ideas are just ideas. And I've just been very fortunate, in particular going to a chamber breakfast and meeting a former president of a local TD Bank and just sharing this crazy little wonky idea that I had and him saying, well, here's my card, call me, I'll give you money, right? And that's what you really need.
And that's
a lot
how it started,
and that's how you started.
Because it's not actually free. You pay for it. It's just free for the folks to come.
Right. Yeah. You know, and this program has grown from maybe a couple hundred people going to now, I would say this past year, we averaged about 1,200 people per event.
Yeah.
So it's just always trying to keep it going, keep it fun. People really do like it. And next year will be our 10th summer.
Yeah. You being successful for your own goals, for your own reasons, help me achieve the success I want to see. And we don't have to be doing it for the same reason, right? And so everything you've described is about how it can create positive interactions with police officers. It can build trust in community. It can create safe places for kids, all of that. In my lens, through my lens, part of what Summer Fun and Films is doing and what you are doing is enhancing the quality of life in this region in a way that retains families who could move somewhere else and take their talent and their skills and their income elsewhere. It attracts people. So like you are doing economic development activity and you are helping achieve the goals I am working on by doing what you do, which is why any chance we have a chance to support Summer Fun and Films, we try to, because for all of your own reasons, you are also helping work towards the vision of this region that I am working towards. And I think there's so much of that that people might not recognize, that like, you don't have to be doing something for the same reasons that I'm doing it, but our strategies and our work are kind of mutually beneficial and supporting each other. And so, you know, thanks for what you're doing towards economic development too, because at the end of the day, you know, that's how I think of the activities that you're doing. And yes, because it's, you know, improving police relationships, but
I think more importantly now it's about community. And that's one of the things that I think the purpose has changed from day one to where we are now. And it's really about the community. One of the things that I hear frequently throughout the summers, and many of my volunteers and people like that are part of the program here, is essentially stuff to the effect of, you know, we're really poor. This is the only thing I can do with my child for the summer. This is their summer vacation. Yeah. This is a trip to Disney for them, you know? And these are things that the entire team, including myself, we don't take lightly. And if that's what it is and that's what it means to people, then we're going to deliver, and we need to deliver, and we should. We got to give people that alternative.
Yeah.
Because if all they get is negative or misery, then we can't be surprised with the outcome. So who knows? Maybe they're getting some inspiration. That would be cool. But at the very least, maybe they're also just at the minimum getting a break and having joy, which I think is important. And that's one of the things that I think is vital to Summer Fun and Films. And the other thing I really am proud about the program is the fact that we're able to support. You know, you hear terms like a circular economy, right? I take your money, you give it to me so I can organize this program, but then I take your money and then I give it to this other local business here, and that stays local, right? And I really like the fact that I'm able, and I have all my vendors that I'm able to pay for. They're all reasonable too with their rates. I don't want to shortchange them on that. But like, it's all local people.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the reason why the program's been a success, is that it's the home team.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that comes through. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see what a generation of Summer Fun and Film kids will be like in their 20s and what that does to our community as a whole, right? Like, I could fast forward 10 years and a whole generation I'll be here for that. And I'm excited to see what it looks like. Your leadership role with Summer Fun and Films isn't the only way in which you've led. You've led in times of challenge too. So you stepped into leadership roles during some tough times, like during COVID. You did some COVID outreach. There's been other times that you've had to kind of step into those roles. What did you learn about yourself and about leading under pressure in those moments?
I learned that I can.
Yeah.
I really, one of the things that was interesting with COVID, I mean, everything's new. Right. And the playbook was being written while we were doing it. And that time that I was part of the communications team that the city stood up was in the very beginning.
Yeah.
You know, and it was,
I remember those days.
Yeah.
I was 6 months into this role and nothing had its own playbook.
No.
No.
A lot of fear. And one of the things that kind of the reason why we started the communications team is back then, I remember, I think it was 60 Minutes, I had done a piece, and they were kind of talking about two different responses in two communities. One community, basically, we have COVID, and of course, everything was locked down, isolate, you know. And so they did, but then panic was erupting because, okay, I'm running out of food in my house. Now what do I do? You're telling me I can't go to the grocery store. All right, the grocery stores, you know, and it created problems. And he had another community that they kind of isolated this whole neighborhood. But this community was like, all right, here's the number you call. So they had the boundaries, they had the isolation, but anything that they needed, no matter how big or small, they made sure that those needs were addressed. And they did not have the kind of chaos going on. And so that was kind of the origins is why we stood up our communications team back then, was to try and really get ahead of and mitigate potential chaos, you know, and misinformation, because there was a lot of misinformation and confusion. One that really sticks out in my mind was both the hospitals were working together to come up with like a mass testing location at the Armory. People didn't realize that. And we unfortunately didn't really do a good job putting out information. We did not do a good job putting out information in advance about what was going on. So what did people think was going on? They thought they were setting up an emergency morgue. preparing for mass casualties, right? And all of a sudden, that really elevated tensions, concerns, and fear. And you know, a good lesson to be to learn from that is that while we did correct that and make clear what was going on at the Armory, we also unfortunately did it several days later.
Yeah,
and you can never catch up to the initial buzz, mm-hmm. right? And that's the importance of communication. Strong communication, explanation, dictation lets people understand what is going on, reduces that panic, and also gives them a clear understanding and direction of where we're going or what we're doing. And that's one of the things I think is extremely important from any leadership perspective, is taking that time to talk, explain, but also probably more importantly, to listen, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, in part, that was, I'm sharing a little bit of a stumbling here, but it was also listening mm-hmm. and was what drove our counter response to that. But when you listen to people and you pay attention to what's going on, it gives you the opportunity. You're always going to be somewhat in a state of reaction, right? But the issue or the difference is going to be reacting to something small or its beginning stages
yeah.
or really trying to overly compensate and react to something that's mushroomed out. And the reality is if you get it early, it's going to require a lot less energy and effort.
Yeah.
And if you're at the end of it or when it's mushroomed out, it's going to require a lot more energy and a lot more effort mm-hmm. to mitigate.
I wish there was more leaders who learned this lesson, is the ownership. So like leading takes ownership. And if there's a misstep or if something could have been done better, the quick recognition and the quick ownership of it for me is such a sign of leadership. And that's what I heard you just describe as well, is that piece. And sometimes it gets missed, but like, you know, if the coach or the quarterback doesn't call the audible on the field, own that didn't work and have a better play next time, what are you even doing? I know I'm such a football mom, but
well,
it's
know,
football
that's,
season, guys.
My mentor, by and large, has been former police chief Michael Boosier. And some of the things that he instilled in me, and he was the one who put me on the community resource team and got me out there. And, you know, we wound up really working well together and in tandem. But some of the things that I learned from him and he made very clear to me is this, is that when you're right, you're right. That's really important is that sometimes you may be in a room with one person or facing an audience of people. But if you're right and they are wrong, then you need to stand your ground and not cave. You need to explain why you're right and why they're wrong, for sure. But when you're right, you're right. The other component to that is, of course, is when you're wrong, you're wrong.
Yeah.
And that's always the more challenging part, of course, because...
I mean, it doesn't feel good.
It doesn't feel good.
It's better to be right.
Nobody likes to be. But when you're wrong, you're wrong.
Yeah.
And the key to that is this. Own it if you're at fault. And then the best thing to do right away is now come up with a solution to resolve and address
yeah.
it. And it's been my experience ever since those kind of values were instilled in me is that, okay, I messed up or we messed up. Let's do this. Does this sound like a solution? Okay. And then that follow through. Right. And when I've never found anybody to hold a grudge over the initial mistake.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And honestly, one of the things that's tricky about trust, and I see this organizationally with my employees, like we talk about being a people first organization, you know, that's often a really important part of our hiring and interview process, both for us and for the candidate to think about fit. But the reality is I can't get that trust from you until you've tested it. Mm-hmm. And so it takes the first day that a new employee is saying, like, you know, my kid is sick or I'm not feeling well and I, you know, something came up, and for us to say, like, that's okay.
All right. You say you're a family-friendly organization, but prove it when you're actually...
Right. And then, but like, it isn't until I get the op, because I can say that, but if you never have to leave early, if you never have to call in sick, and you don't see anyone else taking advantage of that, like, quote-unquote benefit, then you just get stuck wondering, like, do they really mean it? Like, the trust isn't built until it's been tested.
Absolutely.
And I think that's such a key... I think most people find those bad moments, the uncomfortable ones, the painful ones, whether it's a lesson learned or a wrong that was perpetrated, you know, it doesn't feel good. And I just think really thinking about those moments as opportunities for ownership and building trust, because that's where you can prove to someone, when I make a mistake, I own it.
Mm-hmm.
And I make it better. You don't get that opportunity to build that trust and to prove that about yourself unless you've made a mistake. And so I think it's just such a different way to think about failures and learning opportunities and trust building than I think most people think, like, if I've never broken your trust, that's how I have it. And I'm like, you've never proved your trust.
Right.
If that is the case. I think another area in your work that all of that very much relates to, you are really well trusted within our immigrant community. And you've been building relationships within that community, going to local mosques, going to local meetings, at least if not before your Crow era, right? Mm-hmm. I see other leaders who are trying to work across cultures and across difference and to build relationships with folks who are just not the same as them. What would you share? What lessons might you offer to folks who are trying to work across cultures or to figure that out or improve that aspect of their own leadership?
You just do it. When I think back to before I had my first meeting at the mosque, I spent more time in a few weeks before that thinking about, you know, how should I approach it? What should I do? Is this right? Should I wait? You know,
How do I prepare?
Yeah. And the reality is this, just go knock on the door.
Yeah.
What I've learned from that experience, because it's very different, right? I mean, I'm adopted, but I grew up in basically a white Catholic French.
Franco.
Right? So that's what I know.
Mm-hmm.
And so our Muslim community couldn't be any more polar opposite than that in many ways. However, when you go across that threshold and you start talking to them, we actually have a lot of similarities. And the other thing that I really learned from the experience is, and continues to this day, is that people generally want to talk. They want to explain. They want to share their story with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really not as challenging as you may feel when you're having an encounter with a stranger or with a population. I have found they're eager and excited to have audience, to talk to somebody who's outside of their community and share their values or share their customs, beliefs, and why, and explain things. And honestly, it's also your willingness to just ask. And what you only know what you know, and you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
And I think that when I look back on some of those years of earlier meetings and stuff like that, and establishing that trust, was listening to them, but also asking them, so why do you do this?
Yeah.
What's this? What does Eid mean in relation? And they were always really good at explaining things to me. And that also led to cross-cultural, where they would also want to know about me and my upbringing and where I went. And it actually led to me bringing a bunch over to St. Dom's, where I went to high school, so they could see what a Catholic mass looked like and tour St. Dom's and meet with the priest at the time back. You know, so it was just kind of neat. But again, that's that culture exchange. And what I really gleaned from all that was, like, we're really not as different as you would think.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what it comes down to.
There's just so much more in common than there is different. I mean, with almost any groups of people, like, we still fiercely care usually about our families, about safety, about our community, about, you know, stability. Like, we have all of these shared values.
Absolutely. You know, one thing I don't take lightly from those years of relationship building is the amount of trust that they have in me. They call me, they have my number, and get calls all the time or at most random times. But I think that's also the key to it, is, like, you have to answer their call.
Yeah.
Or anybody's call, really. If you say you care, that's great. And kind of going back to where we're pro family, call us, and but if you don't actually, then And so taking those phone calls, helping them navigate those situations, the amount of trust, I don't take that lightly, and I don't want to betray it. But one of the things that I've learned, I had to acknowledge years ago and still today, is that you can't also over rely on me.
Yeah.
And there was a period of time there where there was a lot of reliance on me to be their voice and stuff like that. And I would have to push back on them and say, well, let me get you in a room with the person. Because ultimately, I don't share their experiences. I don't live their lives. I'm not, for a number of reasons. And also, I'm doing them an injustice by just talking on their behalf.
Yeah.
And so, here we are today, and I would say things are a lot different. They do advocate on their own. They've made their own connections and resources beyond me. It's not them, then the broader community, and me in the middle, kind of connecting the two. And I think that's really neat. But it's obviously something that needs to continue to grow.
Fantastic advice. Let's talk about thriving. Let's talk about that beautiful space where we're not just surviving or we're not getting by, right? We're thriving. And for you, I think some of the places that I see you thrive are beyond your badge, right? So you've championed arts and culture projects like murals, the Summer Fun and Film Series. I know that both in whatever ways you can through your work avenues, but then in so many others outside, like in your own volunteer activities and board service, you believe in the arts. You believe in what it does for community. You kind of double down on arts, not just murals and visual arts, but performing arts and music. And, you know, it is not Shakespearean plays that you're bringing to the block parties, right? Right. And so, like, you have diverse interest and you bring it to all of these spaces. What is it about creativity and culture that you think is so important to community well-being and to your own well-being?
For one, I always like a challenge. And one of the things that's nice is when you go outside of your comfort zone, you get a lot more experience, knowledge, and understanding about things. So for me, a lot of these, I call them to myself hobby projects. But it's a way for me to see how to build and design and do things. You know, you can talk about economic development or art installations or producing, but it's just talk unless you actually really get a chance to do it, right? And so one of the things that I look at this, I would say this, historically speaking, as much as I grew up in an artistic household, my parents are both theater buffs and I grew up around musical theater in particular, I would say I probably was more art indifferent.
Really?
Yeah. In passing, one of the terms that I started to hear quite a bit about was the creative economy, mm-hmm. and the understanding that, of course, like if you want to have vibrancy in your community, you need art, you need things going on. It's that, you know, live, work, play, right? It's that play yeah. component. And that's also important to have so that people come here and stay here. I understood it. I mean, from a logical sense, I'm like, okay, that makes sense.
Academically, textbook wise, mm-hmm. you're like, turn the page, makes sense.
Yeah. You know, because generally speaking, I mean, they don't have the stereotype of starving artists for no reason, right?
Yeah.
Starving artists are your laborers. They work in your restaurants. They're your server, right? So if you want a bustling Lisbon Street with a lot of restaurants, you also want to support a creative economy because those are also going to be the employees that are going to help those uplift those restaurants and provide you the service. Then when on their off time, they're going to build up the art and change the atmosphere and bring that action or entertainment here. And it gives you, again, another dimension of the activity to do here. But again, it was much more of an act like, okay, I get it. Like, that makes sense. But while I was doing some work for the Department of Justice, that took me down to Richmond, Virginia. And that was a very transformative experience. Now, the reason why I was there for the DOJ, that was really cool. It was about revamping the broken windows theory and what we would now dub community-defined disorder. And that was an incredible experience and maybe a whole other podcast. But one of the things that really took me back is while I was walking around in Richmond, I'm like, well, this is interesting. A few things that I just noticed. One, here I am in the Confederate capital, right?
Yeah.
And yet I have never been in a community where I felt that where you went out to eat and you saw people of many racial backgrounds in particular sitting at a table and actually seemed very natural. Like I still don't really feel like I see that even here yet. You know, we're still kind of separated. So that took me. Another was the greenery, a lot of greenery in Richmond that you don't typically see in urban environments. And then most importantly, it was just a feel. There was a vibe. And I'm like, what is it? And then one of the things that just really started catching my eye was like, there's large murals all over the place. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when you start looking at murals and then you look in front, there's sculptures, there's a whole slew of art. But it was just the murals. I'm like, I wonder why. And so while I was riding around with a cabbie, I just asked him, I'm like, hey, I just noticed all these murals. Why is there so many? And he explained to me that they had a city ordinance that requires if you have X number of square footage publicly facing that you have to have art on them. And then I looked it up and they have like 150 page guidance book on it. It sounds like a lot, but actually if you read it, it's really not terribly.
It's navigable.
It's very navigable, very unrestrictive. But it was really cool, and that was really transformative to me because then I was like, okay, that's that's that feeling, right? Mm-hmm. That positive feeling. I liked it. You know, there's no theme, if you will. It was just art, right? And I think that's also important. Mix. And I think that high density and high frequency just changes your mood, changes the environment. Mm-hmm. So I came back from that trip from Virginia and that first one, a convert. Like I said, indifferent before, came back, okay, I get it.
I drank the Kool-Aid. Let's figure out the arts economy.
Yeah. So again, here, I mean, one of the things that we talked a lot about during the broken windows discussion was how really it's misused and mistoted as being about aggressive enforcement of low level offenses. That's typically how you hear police CEOs talk about it, and that's how most people relate to it. But when we had the protege of the original theorists at this conference, and I guess this is where it all kind of ties together, it was really actually about community pride, community ownership, and really positive peer pressure, neighborhoods setting a tone for what's allowed. And if neighborhoods feel strong and are able to do that, then these people doing nefarious business on the corners are not comfortable, nor are they welcomed. Yeah. And the police are there to support the neighborhood in defining those norms, but the police don't have to define the norms on their own.
Yeah.
So that's where I was like, okay, art matters. So I came back here. Again, kind of on a whim, we had the Choice Neighborhood money, and we're coming up on a deadline where funds were either going to have to be returned or essentially lost, or they need to be spent. And it was lines for public art and Misty Parker, that creative genius that we had here. Mm-hmm. She came up to me and just asked me, like, hey, you know, this fell through. I need something. And you got like 6 weeks.
Which one was that? Which was the first piece?
So the first one was the Birds of Paradise at the corner of Bartlett and Walnut Street. You know, what was really neat about that is like when you think about a large two-sided mural and how do you do this and stuff like that, it sounds maybe overwhelming, but really here's the deal. I drove around and I said, all right, I need to find brick walls, in particular within the Tree Street neighborhood, which is hard to find.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of choice. And then I found one, right? And now it's at Bartlett and Walnut. And then I was like, okay, so now what? Well, go online, go to City Records, look up, see who the owner is, look up their LLC, and just keep digging, and eventually I got...
Almost like a detective would.
Like a detective
weird.
Would. But now it's the weird... This is where it gets weird. That stuff's easy, I guess. But now I have to cold call somebody who doesn't know who I am, who lives down at Old Orchard Beach. Well, actually, my first phone call was to the owners, the former owners. They had just sold the building within a couple of weeks of my phone call to them. So they said, well, here's the new owner's information. So it's even more. And I cold called them and I basically said, hey, I introduced myself, told them I'm kind of a crazy cop. But I had this idea and I want to put a mural on your building. And here's the deal. I'm going to fundraise for it. All I'm asking for is your wall, maybe a little bit of money from you because I think it's important that you have some financial stake into it. But I'm going to basically make it. I always call them mural babies. But like I'm going to take everything put together so we have a mural. And you know what? This guy, he was great. And he's like, all right, I'm in.
I remember him being so supportive at the ribbon cutting.
He was. And then it just was off to the races. We had friends, Sandy Markey, in particular, they're part of the Blue Jay mural. Of course, now deadlines. So I'm like, I don't even know who's an artist, who paints murals. And I'm also putting something on this guy's wall. So it needs to last, not like just be a 1 year thing.
And look good.
And that's how I got in touch with the color wizard, Jared Gillette, who also, I would say, when he took my phone call, was kind of like, show me the money first.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about you. All fair. But things came together. He painted that mural. Then shortly thereafter, I found another pot of money and another wall. And that led to the splash of color on Lower Lisbon Street. And then eventually to the third piece, which is Vibrant Visions at the corner of Ash and Bates Streets.
And that one's three-sided.
That one's
just
three-sided.
Just up in your own game there. Two-sided to three-sided.
Well, you know, I always take things to the extreme. But it's been really fun to do these and see this. I love all of the pieces. It's still kind of shocks me when I drive by to think about, in some ways, how quickly these came together.
Yeah.
But how cool they are, how vibrant they are, how people really gravitate towards them. The one that I'm probably the most fond of is actually Vibrant Visions, which is the three-sided one.
Yeah.
That one was really neat. And again, I can't emphasize this enough. Believe it or not, I'm an introvert. And if anything, I put on a show of being an extrovert. But when you go to things and put yourself out there, it's amazing who will come to you.
Yeah.
The Vibrant Visions came to be because I went to a ribbon cutting that the chamber was doing out of
I love the chamber threads in this
for some plug-in electric car chargers on the way mobile. And it was funny because just a couple of weeks before, Misty Parker was like talking to me about let's find some more walls, and so she had sent me the walls at the Consolidated Communication. It's like, what about this wall? And that was just it. There was like, these could be cool walls. I don't know. Yeah. This is who owns it. Nothing else had happened with that. So there, we had just finished a ribbon cutting, and this woman, Jen, she was the manager for the building, happened to be there filling up her fleet car for Consolidated Communications. But for whatever reason, she knew me. So she comes up to me and introduces herself and tells me who she is. And I'm like, oh, you work at... And she's like, I'm like, oh, that's funny. And she,
you pull a picture of her brick building out. I'm thinking about your canvas, ma'am.
And she was like, yeah, I've been wanting to talk with somebody about art because we did this down in Portland and I would love to have something on my wall. And I was like, wow. I mean, so that's like...
I would also love to have something on your wall.
Right. And so like, it was just really cool. And one of the things that was really neat with Consolidated was basically, we trust you. Here's a letter. Literally, they wrote a letter that said, Joe Philippon can make all decisions. We don't care. Just
good luck. Make it pretty.
Do whatever you want to do. So in terms of creativity, and, you know, Jared came up with a lot. If I go through my emails, we have so many great renderings and all of them should be put up somewheres, and all of them can and will, I'm sure, at some point. But one of the things I challenged them, like, I can find walls all over the place for people who are maybe not so comfortable with going outside of the box. Consolidated says, do whatever you want to do. And so we just push, and finally we came onto Vibrant Visions. And what I really like about that abstract, or one, it's an abstract, so people see whatever they want to see. But
because the long wall is abstract, maybe with a B in it. And then the two parallel walls, I mean, is abstract color schemes, but like, it's eyes.
No, they're definitely eyes.
Right.
So one of the things, so when I look at Vibrant Visions and what I see when you start on the Park Street side with the blue set of eyes, to me, you know, it's representative of looking toward, they look towards the river. And that's the foundation of Lewiston. Somebody came here, saw the river, saw potential, saw our power and our energy. The city was built up along the river. And the mismatch of colors on the face and the different shapes represent to me the different types of people that had to come together to build Lewiston. The long side of the wall that's more rainbow colored with the bees and stuff like that, to me just is that interwovenness, kind of pays homage to weaving, manufacturing, the bees, industrial, so that growth. But then the last set of eyes on the Bay Street side of the building that look at, to me, it's about looking onward, right? So Lewiston was built up along the river. We became bigger, and then we looked beyond our horizon. And that's to me what Vibrant Vision is. Mm-hmm. And when I look at that, it's just that drive, especially the eyes on Bates Street. So the eyes on Park Street I see as vision and exploration. But the eyes on Bates Street I see more as like determination, grit.
Yeah.
You know, creation. And so I look at that, and to me that's where I think Lewiston is, right?
Those are all words I would use to describe. Right?
Yeah.
Like grit, determination.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That onward expansion. And I think that obviously right now, you know, our city is looking and we're trying to figure out where to go. Some ways we've healed and some ways we haven't healed. Mm-hmm. But we have to look forward.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. All right. In a short response, tell me when you think about your own, like, looking ahead. You've got your Bates Street eyes on, if you will. What's a dream project or initiative that you'd love to see come to life in Lewiston? Hmm. What have you not tackled you'd love to see come to reality?
Boy, that's a good question. My dream project would be, if I won the Mega Bucks, is I would want to build housing.
Yeah.
I would want to build good, solid, single-family housing in particular. And since I wanted money, I don't need, you know, whatever. But be able to sell that, sell those properties, if you will, at a very low rate to help people in poverty be able to build up their own credit,
yeah,
and then be able to make their own decision as to whether or not they want to keep that property or sell it at the market rate, but to just try and elevate people. That would be one project or initiative that I wish I could do.
I love that. I think it's such a good way to build wealth and to break generational poverty, homeownership, and it's just so hard to attain. I mean, in the good times when housing costs weren't as high as they are now, and you know, interest rates weren't as, but like, it's always been the best way for people to grow their wealth, and particularly people who are born into generational poverty, to start to break that cycle. Yeah, I love that vision.
Yeah, it's just, I think that one of the things that's was challenging for a lot of people in our community, so many of the people that live in our community live in extreme poverty or in poverty, and basically you live to survive just that day, right?
Yeah.
And for our community to be truly healthy and successful, people need to be able to go to bed at night not worried about surviving the mm-hmm. next day, but wondering about what possibilities or options or choices they get to make tomorrow.
Well, we touched on like pride of place. You know, I also think that the truest form of the broken windows theory is about pride of place, or at least I would like to believe it should be about pride of place. But I think that I know this to be true because I was fortunate enough to grow up in a home that my family owned, but I spent a lot of my life in rental. And for me, breaking my own cycle of generational poverty absolutely came from homeownership. And it is really hard to have the stability and the ability to plan for the future when you don't have control of your own housing.
Yeah.
Doesn't even matter that you're a good tenant that always pays on time, right? Like, the building could get sold and you don't have the ownership. You don't have that assurance. And so, you know, are you putting a potted plant on the porch that you can take with you, or are you laying down roots in a garden out back? That, like, even just the ability to have or to show different types of pride are linked to, you know, your ability to know that your space is your space and that you can raise your kids there and start your life there. And I just think there's...
Be safe.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, safety is, you know, I'm a big housing first model fan. Like, how do you pay attention to anything else if you don't know where you're going to sleep tonight, where you're going to lay your kids' heads down? Everything else kind of stems from that. So we always like to close out by thinking about a way that you can pay some of this forward, right? All of the learning and the lessons and what you've built, trust and community. What is one piece of advice that you would share with young people in this community, whether they're thinking about public service or community leadership or just getting involved?
Find your voice and put yourself out there. It can be very scary. And again, this is an introvert talking that most people, I don't think, believe is an introvert. But if you can find your voice, and, you know, even be Shanna, who was afraid of talking, but now is the person who asked that question when everybody's getting ready to leave. When you can do that, it's amazing. I've said it before and I'll continue to say it. I have ideas, but all of the things that I've been able and fortunate to be part of is because I've been able to share those ideas with others. And in turn, others have supported me. If I didn't have their support, whether it be financial, property walls, whatever, publishing, you name it, none of this would happen. And I don't want to take it for granted, even though I do take them for granted in many ways, because I now have a cadre of people that I know that when I have whatever going through my mind is something that I can call, and they believe in me, they trust me, and they say, what is it that you need from me? Because also what I've learned is that everybody, or a lot of people in this community, want to be part of this community, yeah, but they too also don't necessarily know how to plug in and engage. Mm-hmm. And I think that some of the benefits is some of the times, so a lot of things that I've been part of, they say, oh, that's really neat, I like it, how can I, you know, as opposed to I have this idea and I want to do it. So there's a community out here, and there's a great community here. No matter what people say, I've been very fortunate and blessed to be supported by them. Like I said, anything and everything that maybe I'm known to or gets attributed with my name, I'm just the idea person. But The reality is that's all come to be because of a broad range of support from individuals, businesses, nonprofits, grants, foundations, you name it. But it all really comes down to people.
And because you said the idea alone. It's good advice. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Yeah.